You are listening to the RTE Brainstorm Podcast, proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hi, my name is Ella McSweeney, and this is Brainstorm. If you want to know about new ideas from the world around you, then this is the podcast for you. On today's episode, we look at wild Irish lives. Ireland is universally known as the land of saints and scholars. Our literary history, coupled with prominent figures across the arts and entertainment industries, have brought us acclaim. And Ireland has certainly been known for its distinctive personalities. The name Bill Fuller might not mean much to you, but he does typify the wild Irish life and one that should be remembered. Joining me is Michael Murphy, journalist, author, lecturer, music and talent manager. Michael, before we get into the details of his life, which is extraordinary, just tell me why people should care. What is it about this guy? Who was he and what did he do?
I think people should care because Ireland is really proud of its musical acts. It's a huge export. It's a source of joy. But we often don't understand who helped those artists to get heard in the first place. And the more I researched, the more I realised Bill Fuller. Who is this guy? And he's from Kerry. And he's born in 1917, but he's one of Ireland's greatest entrepreneurs, particularly for his era.
And not just in terms of music, but also construction. I mean, this guy was a major developer as well.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're looking for a way to make money in an impoverished, newly independent country, construction, manual labour, that's going to be one of the options for you. So he's a guy, a big guy, a boxer. And he leaves Kerry. He goes to London, which is incredibly foreign, incredibly hostile to the Irish. And he makes it. He changes London.
And ends up in America.
He ends up in America, but America is just one of the places he ends up. He's a man who is seen in lots of different places. He's a man who doesn't keep a schedule. So he's this incredibly mysterious figure, even during his lifetime.
And there's very little archive of him, isn't there? I mean, this is a guy who did not want really to anyone to put a microphone in front of his mouth.
Yeah, he didn't do a lot of self-promotion. He didn't do a lot of media interviews. He got on with the job. But you'll find that with a lot of business people. They're too busy. If they're on Dragon's Den, it's because they're not busy enough making money. This guy was busy.
Making a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay, take us back. 1917, North Kerry. He was born to shopkeeper parents.
You can imagine life in Ireland. We're one of the poorest parts of Europe at that moment in our history. We're fighting for independence. We're looking to establish ourselves on the global stage. We have a huge diaspora. And sometimes the diaspora is the only way out for these guys, you know, growing up in rural Ireland.
And he did the thing that so many people did. He caught the train to London as a teenager.
Yeah, but brilliantly. There's not a lot of money floating around. What money is floating around is in this kind of subsistence economy. So he organises dances. The Irish have always wanted to dance. Now, the government have tried to stop Irish people dancing, and particularly in the 1930s. But he organises dances locally to raise a couple of bob. Who benefits from local dances? Everything in Ireland is political. So he's raising money for his uncle, who's running for political office. So there's that moment where you can see how political dancing was in rural Ireland. And he's the man as a teenager. He apparently, now, according to the priest who spoke at his funeral, he was a great man for avoiding farm work, but he wasn't afraid of work, you know. And I think he must have been incredibly ambitious. He had his eye on a much, much bigger prize than who can shovel the most stuff in an hour.
So he found himself in London in his late teenage years, got into construction by 20. He owned his own construction firm. What was he doing at that time?
Well, there was a market for the Irish to go and roll up their sleeves in England, to do the dirty jobs. Women became domestic servants and the lads went into building. This is in the 1930s, but you've got to anticipate what's going to happen after that. And what happens after that, World War II, we remain neutral. All of the British men go into combat. There are no men in England. to do construction work. And Bill Fuller, because he left as a teenager in the 30s, he's well established enough that he's able to organize gangs of laborers. There were a number of entrepreneurs from Kerry who went into construction, and Bill was one of them. But Bill didn't just limit himself to construction, but he was brilliant enough that by the age of 20, he had his own company in a foreign country.
And he was a hustler from an early age, wasn't he? There's that story about the Buffalo on Camden High Street and the police saying, no, we're not reopening that place. There's loads and loads of problems there.
Well, Bill Fuller went to Inspector Harris, and Inspector Harris was a hard-nosed British cop, and he was sick of the messing at the Irish bar. Now, there's a lot of racism there. And Bill went down and said, look, I'll take it over. I'll run it. And if you ever have to come down because there's trouble, I'll put a lock on the door and shut it forever. And to ensure that happened, he stood at the door himself. And he wasn't afraid of punching a guy who he thought might start a fight inside. So he was incredibly involved in the disciplining of the Irish in England to make sure they didn't get in trouble with the cops in his venue.
And as a rural Irish immigrant, I suppose he must have understood one thing, which is Irish people wanted to meet Irish people. They wanted to dance. They wanted to romance together. And that was the backbone of his business, wasn't it? Buying and selling ballrooms.
Yeah, absolutely. He brought so many people together. He gave social opportunities to so many Irish people. You can imagine shipping up to England, hostile environment, going to America, completely alien environment. You're going to look for other Irish people. And Bill provided those opportunities by building an international chain of Irish ballrooms.
During that time in England, was he going back to Kerry? Was he sending money back? What was he doing?
He was making a lot of money. Now, we don't know where the money was going. And the flow of Bill Fuller's money would be a great study in itself. But he was part, because World War II becomes incredibly important economically to Ireland. And we are completely dependent on the remittances of our people who leave to go and work in England. And Suggs from Madness, in his autobiography, he's got this great line that, you know, around their neighbourhood where they were growing up in Camden, they used to say, anything that Hitler didn't knock down, Bill Fuller did. Because Bill would come in to knock down unsafe buildings after bombing raids. So he was known around the area for construction. He employed hundreds of Irish people. And during World War II, the big construction firms went to Irish villages. They found someone from Listowel and they said, come with us and let's find more people to do manual labour. Now, they were sprayed. This was not a glamorous move from Ireland to England. They were sprayed with disinfectant before they were allowed into England. Like, the Irish were not seen as part of mainstream British life. But Bill Fuller quietly, and maybe because he shut up about it, and maybe you had to shut up if you were Irish at that time in Britain, he just got on with making the money.
What kind of character was he on a day-to-day basis, in as much as we know? Was he belligerent? Was he good? Was he positive? What kind of person was he?
No one knows the real Bill Fuller. We just have fragments. You know, you can glean little bits, little insights, but he was a private man. He was too busy getting on, living his life to leave much of a trail or a legacy. He was a kind of a Scarlet Pimpernel of Irish economic and cultural history. So he goes to America. He marries one of our first female pop stars. He marries Carmel Quinn. Dublin, good voice. She plays in his clubs because he opens in Dublin the Crystal Ballroom. Later it becomes McGonagall's. He moves the family to New York. She goes on the radio on the Arthur Godfrey show and Americans love her. So she becomes our first pop star. She becomes, globally, she becomes our first female singer to get on the Billboard charts. And so he was a great manager of people. He was clearly someone who understood what the Irish wanted in terms of entertainment. But he didn't stop there. He thought, if I can entertain the Irish, I can entertain everyone. So he was someone who, I think, lived by his absolute own star. No one told this man what to do. But he changed the face of rock and roll, which isn't known.
How extensive did he become in America? I mean, was it the same idea that he had in England, which was, let's get the Irish in first? There's more Irish coming all the time, so it's a sure market for him. Was it the same idea in America?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we have a huge diaspora in America. I'd say most Irish people have a relative going back a couple of generations who's living there. And Bill Fuller, he opened the Carousel Ballroom in San Francisco. He opens the Manhattan Ballroom in New York. He opens a ballroom in Boston. And they're centres of the Irish community. But if you have the Irish dancing, you have the Irish talking, you have the Irish thinking about home. So he brings over the show bands. So he's solely responsible for the success of the show bands outside of Ireland. And, you know, we were reading the magazines growing up and, oh my God, they played in New York. They're on tour in America. And it's like, actually, they're on tour at Bill Fuller's venues. You know, that's America in terms of music, in terms of the show band era. America for Irish bands was one man, and that man was Bill Fuller.
He was the engine behind all of it.
He was the complete engine behind the success of Irish people abroad. But there's something really important for the Irish, because there's no telephones. You can't keep in touch. So when the show bands would play Bill Fuller's venues, they would often say, is Mary from Letterkenny here? Frank and Michael, say hello. Because when the show bands toured Ireland, it would be known that they were going to play in London, and they would get notes saying, please, will you remember and mention our sister? Now, that could be a sister that they'd never see again. So Bill Fuller is allowing some kind of social connection between the Irish abroad. And he's the connector between the Kennedys in Ireland, because he's coming back and forth. You asked, you know, was he going back and forth? He was, but he never told anyone. So all of his venues were managed by exceptional managers, generally Irish. So we had the brilliant entrepreneurs, brilliant business people, but we don't know about them. And he's probably the exemplar. He's probably, there's no better businessman of that era than Bill Fuller.
And he knew enough to get in with the politicians.
The politicians knew enough to get in with Bill Fuller. Bill Fuller held the power because he could get you to the diaspora audience. He could get you to shake hands with JFK. And when JFK gets elected president, he says, thank you, Bill. You've been very helpful to me and the family. Will you help us to put on the entertainment? So who's appearing at the White House? It's our girl from Dublin, Carmel Quinn. So Carmel Quinn plays at the White House, thanks to her husband. She becomes a national celebrity in the States. And she becomes the embodiment of Ireland, of the Colleen, but it's also the progressive Irish. This is the 1950s, but she's Bill's wife. They're a power couple. And she's exuding a flair and a confidence that wouldn't have been part of the Irish representation before that. So he's a vital figure in how we're seen. And the politicians have to dance to his tune. The most important deal that he does happened at Shannon Airport. And he was back in Ireland because he had opened venues. He opened Chock Furbo in Galway. He had plans to develop Galway into a luxury marina. He wanted to build a skyscraper in Dublin. He was refused planning permission. So he thought, I'll build it in Cork. He was refused planning permission. This is the 1960s when no one's investing in Ireland. No one's thinking of building a skyscraper. So he's completely full of a vision for a future Ireland. He's not living in the current Ireland. He's seeing how it can be. And there's a guy in San Francisco who's thinking, I need somewhere for rock and roll bands to play. Rock and roll is growing steadily. Psychedelic rock. And Bill Fuller is in Ireland. And this man decides, I want to buy Bill Fuller's venue. And he flies to Shannon Airport. And Bill is there to meet him. And his name is Bill Graham. And he goes on to be the architect of the live music industry in the US. And he writes about it. And he said, I met this big Irish guy. And I gave him a bit of the spiel about why I wanted to buy his venue, what it would do for the city. And Bill wasn't interested. And Bill, he said, forced him to drink a load of pints, whiskey, and a big Irish fry breakfast. And he said he was very nervous because it would be the making of his business if he could find a venue for bands like the Grateful Dead. And then that becomes Jimi Hendrix and Cream. It becomes the entry point for British rock to break America. And it's thanks to our guy, Bill Fuller. And Bill Fuller says to Bill Graham, I'll sell it to you. And this American huckster can't believe it. He said, well, do we have to talk to the lawyers? Do you have to check with people? And Bill says, no, my handshake is good. That's all you need. And they do a handshake deal after a couple of hours. And suddenly, psychedelic rock in the States has a home. And it's thanks to our guy from Kerry. Keep in mind, you know, Albert Reynolds is a key figure in the Irish music industry during the 1960s. But it's a cash economy. So these people in a very, very poor country without that much entrepreneurship, they're making hand over fist by letting people dance, socialize, like a really basic function that the church had done for so long, well into the 1950s. They're still there in the 1960s, but there's a pushback by entrepreneurs like Bill Fuller. So he's a key part. There's no record of close relationships between Bill Fuller and the Catholic Church. But the parish priest down in Kerry, who gave the eulogy at his funeral service, you know, mentioned that he was a brilliant entrepreneur. And that's really interesting because how many other great Irish business people do we know that were born in 1917? There's very, very few.
What did he do with his money?
Well, like anyone else who makes a lot of money, he spent it and he looked for other ways to make more. So he almost rewound the clock by 100 years and he went prospecting for gold in Las Vegas. He's from Kerry, so he's used to the mountains and he's used to prospecting. And, you know, he's a risk taker.
Was he flamboyant? Was he a big spender? Did he like the good life?
We don't know how he liked to live because he did it in such privacy. He made the rules. There was no media intrusion. You know, famously, the Sunday World tried to interview him. And the article is a lovely story about how a younger journalist can get punched in the face by an older Irish Kerry entrepreneur. But Las Vegas is the America's party capital. But it's also Bill Fuller's town. But before that, it was the Mafia's town. You didn't play in Las Vegas unless the Mafia gave you a little bit of a nod and a wink. And what's extraordinary in Bill's story is that he was able to find a niche in Las Vegas, a Mafia town at that moment. And he just rocked up and said, I'm putting on Irish show bands. So that was incredibly important to Ireland. It brought credibility from the American audience as well, because people thought, okay, so there's an Irish band. We've never heard of them, but they're playing like on the strip. That's thanks to Bill. And, you know, when Brendan Boyer goes out to play in Las Vegas, it's not old Ireland. These guys aren't standing in their suits. They're twisting, they're dancing, and they've got young female dancers as part of their presentation. So that's Bill. Before McGonagall's becomes a rock venue, Bill, now this probably is one of his worst ideas, he thought, I know what Dublin needs. It needs a nightclub and a wine bar where the women dress in Roman togas. That kind of didn't work. Now, there are photographs. You can go and look at them in your own time. But he, again, that's Bill the modernist. But Bill, I don't give a crap what people think. He had the money. Now, he spent, like, there's certainly lots of anecdotal evidence that he spent the money. He certainly didn't keep records and accounts that he handed over to the state at the end of his life.
And we can presume in Las Vegas he was fine working with the mafia.
We can assume that in Las Vegas, the mafia were fine working with Bill Fuller. We have to understand Bill as one of the greatest entrepreneurs that Ireland has ever produced. And now any Irish entrepreneur will probably get a media profile and we'll understand them. We'll probably get a biography, maybe an autobiography. But Bill is one of the great, possibly the last mysterious, brilliant entrepreneur that Ireland will ever produce.
He died in California in 2008. What do you think, looking back on his life and all that you found out about him, what do you think fundamentally motivated him?
I think fundamentally Bill Fuller was an Irish peasant, to use that word, who realised that the world outside of rural Ireland was a world of opportunities for any Irish person, man or woman, but they'd have to work incredibly hard and they'd have to be incredibly smart and smarter than the people in the countries, the states or Britain, than the people who live there. He's so influential and no one knows him. And maybe that's Bill Fuller's greatest legacy, is that you can just get on with the business. You can be a visionary. You can be incredibly successful and you don't have to talk about it.
Kathleen Cox was a vibrant figure in the Dublin art scene. From the 1920s until she destroyed her ceramic moulds in the 1930s, she produced figurines, masks and busts that portrayed her personal friends and characters from the streets of Dublin. But little is known of her, her work and her motivation. Siobhan Doyle is curator of glass, ceramics and Asian collections at the National Museum of Ireland. Her first book, A History of the GAA in 100 Objects, was published by Merrion Press. Siobhan joins me now to talk about Kathleen Cox. Siobhan, at the end of 2022, you got a phone call from someone who wanted to know if you knew about her mother. And you said, Kathleen who?
Never heard of her. Never heard of her. Kathleen Cox, who was an artist born in China in 1904. She was born to Irish parents. And when she was 7 years old, Kathleen and her family moved back to Ireland. They moved to Listowel first and ended up in Howth. But those 7 years, her earliest years spent in China, had a profound impact on Kathleen for the rest of her life, on her job as an artist, as a potter, and also her culture and various things that she was interested in.
So Kathleen Cox is this potter that you've become very interested in the last year and a half. What is it about her that captured your imagination?
She just, everywhere she went, she had a good story to tell. She had an impact. Something mad happened to her, or, you know, she always had something interesting going on in her life at all times. So whether that was studying in France and having chance meetings with strangers, or forging strong relationships with other artists in the Dublin Metropolitan School of Art, or moving to Dublin to rear her children and completely changing her life. She just had, for one woman, she had a fantastic life. She died in 1972. She was 68 when she died, so relatively short life, but she packed a lot into it. And it's the variety of things that she was capable of in her life that's fascinating to me.
A year and a half ago, her daughter phoned you up and said, "Do you have my mother's work in your collection, Kathleen Cox?" You didn't know who she was. Did you find any of her pieces in your collection?
Yes. Yes, I put Kathleen Cox into our museum object database and got some results, about 8 results, I believe. And it was lovely to be able to get back to Kathleen's daughter and say, yeah, we have some of her ceramics that we collected over the years, sometimes through purchases and sometimes through donations.
As an artist and as a potter and a ceramicist, where does she rank?
I suppose she only practiced for a very, she only had a limited time frame for when she actually practiced ceramics in Ireland. And there was no doubt that she was a very talented and skilled potter. But I suppose it's a very small market. And unless you're going to go into the industry working, you know, in a factory for a larger manufacturer, there's only very small space for ceramics in that artistic market. So her works are, I would argue they're collectible now, but they're only really collectible that for people that have heard her story and that are aware of what a fascinating woman that she was. And up until now, that's there's not a whole lot of us that are taken by her.
She's an intriguing, somewhat forgotten figure in the Irish art scene, a strong feminist and someone who began life in China, ended life on a farm in Kent, and in between lived a big and full life. Take us back to China. So she was born of parents from Dundalk. What were they doing in China when she was born, in and around 1902, 1903?
Yeah, so her father worked in, he was a doctor, he was a medical professional. So they travelled around quite a bit, which is how they ended up in China at the time. Those 7 years in China had an impact on Kathleen for the rest of her life.
Could you see that in her subsequent work?
Well, yeah, first of all, with China being so prolific in the ceramics world, I'm sure that had an influence on Kathleen developing her skills in that particular material. It's a place that she always kept in her heart until she died.
So they came back when she was about 7 years old to Ireland. They moved into a big house in Hoste. They must have been fairly well off. And she went to Alexandra College in Dublin. Was she academic?
Yes, she was. Yeah. She was a big reader and a big writer as well. And she was always interested in learning right throughout her whole life, interested in other people, in other cultures, in other religions. So she was really inquisitive.
And decided then to go to college, what was the start of NCAD now, the National College of Art and Design, back then the Metropolitan School of Art in Dublin. Where did she get that idea from, or where did that sort of creativity come from?
Difficult to pin down. I suppose it's important to say that anyone that was in the 1920s that was studying at third level, you know, it wasn't very common. And it definitely wasn't very common to study art full time at third level. So you would have to be from a background of privilege to be able to do so, which Kathleen was.
Mm.
And she made many great friends there, including a woman called Stella Rayner, who she ended up sharing a studio with in Molesworth Street, which is just across from Dáil Éireann. So there they became great friends and, I suppose, took inspiration from each other. They used to have exhibitions on in their studio of their work. And actually two of the pieces that are in the National Museum of Ireland's collection, were two of Kathleen's pieces, were donated by Stella. So it's a nice kind of full circle that Stella held on to that, those pieces belonging to Kathleen, and then saw them worthy of going out of her ownership and into the ownership of the whole of Ireland, of the state.
With her work, was she very much an artist of expression, aesthetics, someone who wanted her work to be on shelves, on walls, to be looked at, to be admired? Or was she trying to make statements, political statements?
It sounded like Kathleen just wanted to make what she wanted to make, which is so admirable, that even though she did delve into the commercial side a little bit, ultimately her work was grounded in the themes that she wanted to develop. It wasn't influenced by you know, some museum or patron that was encouraging her to make things that they wanted. It sounded like she stood on her own two feet and made the art that she believed in.
Was she successful at that time?
It's difficult to gauge success in the artistic world. A lot of the time we measure that by how expensive things are now. But I mean, she had a few exhibitions in studios that seemed to have sold some of her figurines. So whether she made a profit, it's hard to tell.
But she was going to Paris and winning awards, wasn't she? So on the European stage, she was being recognised for her art.
Yeah, she took part in many exhibitions here in Ireland with the Royal Hibernian Academy. She submitted artworks to the art competitions at the Telton Games in the 1920s and 30s. So she was very active here. And she was definitely known in artistic circles around Dublin. Her winning those prizes at the RDS annual awards allowed her to make those trips to Paris to study further. So, yeah, I guess she was getting the attention that she deserved at the time.
And around the early 1930s, she began to develop different beliefs, didn't she? In sort of mystic beliefs, that sort of area. There was a description of her going to an event in Paris, and she had a kind of visionary experience of being at one with the world that really overwhelmed her.
Yeah, Kathleen was someone that was always really deeply in touch with her emotions and her own spirit. And that's something that she carried with her all the time. She totally rejected religion, as in practicing religion, but she was really interested in learning about all religions. So she had a very curious mind, and she made friends everywhere she went, just from bumping into people and just chatting away to them. World War II was looming in the 1930s, and that had a really deep, deep effect on Kathleen. And she got very disillusioned with the world. And in 1935, Kathleen visited an exhibition in London. I believe it was in the V&A. And it was an exhibition of Chinese ceramics. And after that exhibition, Kathleen was totally done with her art after seeing this exhibition of Chinese work. She felt that her art could never change the world, could never make a massive impact. And when she came home from London, she destroyed all her molds in the studio. She sold the electric kiln and closed down their studio. So she definitely was a woman of her word. Yeah.
How are we to understand that? I mean, is that about the rise of Hitler, the impact at that time? Or could you see hints of that previously in her life? Because until then, from what you've said, she sounded like a fairly forward-thinking, happy, content artist. And yet then you have this profound act of demolition. And it's hard to understand in some ways what she was doing.
Yeah, she definitely wore her heart on her sleeve at all times. And I guess it's a testament to the person that she was, the fact that all of this was happening around her and she felt like she couldn't change anything. She couldn't make an impact. So she just gave up on her art. Whereas she could have continued on and been totally oblivious to everything that was unfolding. But she got fed up and she gave up.
Do you think it was the commercialization of ceramics that she saw in the Chinese exhibition that she just thought this is just a marketplace?
I think perhaps the content of that exhibition would have been Chinese ceramics from hundreds and across hundreds of years. And they were all functional. They were all teapots and bowls and vessels and plates. And her passion was creating artworks that reflected motherhood and womanhood and femininity. And if her work was to transcend hundreds of years, that perhaps her more figurative and decorative pieces weren't what would sustain her legacy. But it actually is, because they're the types of works that we have in our National Museum today.
Do you have a sense that her longevity was, after she died, was something that she was interested in, that she wanted to leave a kind of legacy?
You know, I often wonder, when researching people like Kathleen, are they actually going about their days in the knowledge or in the hope that people like us will want to hear their story and delve into it? And I feel like if she did, she wouldn't have broke her molds. She would have continued it. She would have had really intricate documentation of her artworks, of her practice, of her life. And I feel like in that act of destroying her own work, that she didn't really want a legacy in this way.
She then married a man. She lived in Kent on a farm. She had two daughters, and that's where she died in 1972. As a reasonably young woman, actually. She was only in her, what?
She was 68.
Late 60s. Yeah. What do we know about that final phase of her life?
She dedicated her final years to raising her two daughters. She was a woman that was very conscious of the environment. She used to recycle. She was a vegetarian. She would make use of what she had. So she would make dresses for her daughters from curtains. She was able to turn her hand to lots of different things like dressmaking, embroidery, bricklaying, thatching. Grania, her daughter, recalls that anytime they went for a walk, the whole idea was to go out and find something that was of use to nobody else that they could use. So they'd always come home with junk or something to repurpose in their home.
Did she ever do any pottery again?
No. She never practiced her art after that.
And then fast forward to 2022, when you got the call from her daughter, Grania, asking, is Kathleen Cox in your collection? And you did find some. And you are now telling the world about Kathleen Cox, this forgotten figure. What do you think she would make of this?
Well, I know that Kathleen's daughters are thrilled that her story is being told and being kept alive. And I hope Kathleen would be happy that we're having a chat about her today, that she'd be happy that her artworks that she took such care and such skill in creating are on display in our National Museum for all of the public to see.
Is it your sense that there is a lot more out there to be found of her work, even in perhaps even charity shops?
Yeah, I believe so. She didn't sign her works, Kathleen Cox. So she used a particular symbol. So unless you were aware of that symbol, you know, you might just pass them by in charity shops or in antique shops or even in people's homes. That's my fear as a historian and as a curator, is all the things that lie in people's attics that have amazing stories to tell and people don't realise that they're there and realise of their historical and their cultural importance.
Kathleen Lynn was an activist, politician, doctor who was so far ahead of her time in the 1920s Ireland that one of her biggest and bravest ideas is only being realised today. Mary McAuliffe is an historian and lecturer at UCD. Mary, why should we care about Dr. Kathleen Lynn? For people who've never heard of her, don't know anything about her, what is it about her story that is so impressive, important, influential?
Well, I think firstly we should care about her because she is an important Irish person who did service to the state and prior to the state being set up, and indeed a state she didn't totally agree with, was a Republican, a feminist, a medical doctor, did so much in her life for the betterment of the people, particularly women and children, people living in poverty, for medical doctors like herself, for all of women in her campaigns for the right to suffrage. And generally because she is somebody who was an important figure in 20th century Irish history, in the same way we would know about Sean Lemass or other Irish men who, like her, participated in the 1916 Rising and other revolutionary movements, but of course are so much better known to Irish people and are in the history books. Kathleen Lynn is in some history books, but she needs to be in all of them. She was born in Mayo. Her father was a Church of Ireland vicar. Her mother obviously was the vicar's wife. She and her two sisters and brother were born, were brought up in Mayo. They moved around a little bit as her father was posted to different places, but he ended up as the vicar on the Ashford estate in Cong in County Mayo. So she comes from quite a well-got, you know, upper middle class Anglo-Irish background. And how she went from there to being a person locked up during the 1916 Rising as a rebel is an extraordinary journey. She talks about it a little bit herself because, of course, she leaves diaries. Now, she doesn't start her diary till 1916. And at that stage, she's a medical doctor. She's a grown woman with a long history behind her. But her trajectory from Mayo to Dublin is through Alexandra College, that great college set up by women for women, to provide an education for young Protestant girls, because, of course, they weren't allowed third level education initially. And then when that happened, it is also a preparatory college and place of education. But for Kathleen, Alexandra is where she begins to flourish. Not just academically, she's a very, very good student, and we can see she wins prizes and all of that sort of thing in Alexandra. But also they have a philanthropic bent to their training of these young girls, that they are, you know, privileged young women, and that they should be involved in charitable good works and ensuring that, you know, the poor women, children should benefit from their largesse, and they're very much part of that. The Alexandra Guild didn't exist when she was an Alexandra, but is founded soon after she leaves. And that is very influential in her thinking about social housing, for example. Alexandra buys homes and does them up and rents them at cheaper rents to poorer people. This idea that you should have good sanitation, good housing, good access to education and healthcare, all very much part of what she took in Alexandra College. So I think we can't underestimate the importance of her training in Alexandra. She then goes on to the Royal University, takes her medical degree. Of course, there are all sorts of barriers. She can't become an attending at the Adelaide Hospital because they don't have facilities for women.
The Ioneer.
The Ioneer. But she eventually gets her degree and she becomes a medical doctor.
And is it fair to say that she started life coming from that stock as a sort of soft unionist?
Yes.
But that within that journey, she was well on her way to becoming not only a Republican, but in a militant Republican.
I think she comes to that through feminism, firstly, but also she does admit later in life in her diaries when she's self-reflecting on her own journey that she was a soft unionist. And she says around 1900, 1901, I was a soft unionist then, which means she would have been a feminist, but campaigning through the lobbying, letter writing, non-militant suffrage movement, the suffragists, that had started in the mid-19th century, the Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association, on which she's on the committee. She's also involved in women doctors' associations. So she's very much an active public person. She just doesn't take her medical degree and set up her GP practice and go with that. She's also campaigning for the rights of women within the profession and for the rights of women more broadly to access the vote. Because for her, as a professional woman, to be excluded from the franchise was ridiculous. I mean, here she was, being a public woman, being a GP, and not having the right to vote, not having the right to say, having a say in public politics, in national politics, and in transforming that. But you can see she's beginning to move from that more constitutional, non-violent, non-militant suffrage activism to the militancy of the Irish Women's Franchise League and the women like Hannah Shee Skeffington and Helena Maloney quite quickly between about 1901 and 1908 when the Irish Women's Franchise League is actually set up. She knows them. She's associating with them. She has a sort of by marriage kinship with Countess Markievicz, who's beginning to become active then. And of course, Dublin being a very small city, it's much smaller than it is now. They all know each other, all of these active public women. They know each other or know of each other, and they form relationships and they influence each other. And Lynn talks about the fact that it is Helena Maloney who brings her in to the, what she calls the national movement. She's becomes the doctor to the militant suffragettes after 1909 when they are put in prison. She's the one who looks after them when they come out. She's writing letters to the British government about their treatment in prison, particularly if they're being force-fed. But also she is more supportive of violence, which is an interesting thing, because that then allows her to accept militancy as a weapon in campaigning for Irish freedom. She gets involved, of course, with the trade union women then through the 1913 lockout. And she is a doctor to those, the striking workers involved in the soup kitchen in Liberty Hall.
And was 1913, I mean, James Connolly said she was the best of us. Mm-hmm. He obviously had a huge regard for her. Was that the point at well where she point where she realised that politics, she could politicise how she was feeling and what she believed in?
I think the relationship with Connolly and with the other socialist women, the women of the Irish Women's Workers' Union, is really where she begins to see how poverty is political, how this has to be changed through politics, through socialism, through trade union activism. And she then begins to see herself very much as a socialist, and has an idea that this is necessary for the transformation, the true transformation of society, to eradicate poverty, of the type of extreme poverty she was witnessing in the tenements of Dublin. And we all know that the extreme poverty in Dublin at that time.
The infant mortality was 141 babies died per thousand. Today it's 1.8.
Yes, yeah, so yes. And the infant mortality rate, the maternal mortality rate, the houses were falling down, the vivid poverty. It's described, for instance, in another Rebels woman's book, Doing My Bit for Ireland, by Margaret Skinner. She visits Dublin in 1915 and Markievicz takes her on a tour of the tenements. And her vivid description of the filth and dampness and the hard life and the poverty of the people, she was shocked. And she was coming from Glasgow, which was no walk in the park when it came to tenements and poverty. And she had seen that herself in Glasgow. So it was extreme. It was probably one of the poorest cities in terms of tenement dwelling in Europe at that time. And Kathleen Lynn could see the impact that was happening on particularly pregnant mothers and children. The infant mortality rate was just extraordinary.
And her relationship with James Connolly, I mean, clearly they mutually admired each other. How important was he in her willingness to be militant?
Well, I think it's kind of built on her already existing willingness to be militant and to see militancy as important in the suffrage movement. And then with the lockout, of course, the response of the employers and the police beating the striking workers off the streets, killing a number of them. And then the setting up of the Irish Citizen Army as a workers' militia to respond to that state violence. Which she joins. And she joins because women can join it on an equal basis with men. So she becomes the chief medical officer of the Irish Citizen Army. And so is in very close contact with Connolly, but also with the trade union movement and with all of these young women, particularly of the Irish Women's Workers Union who are joining the Irish Citizen Army. So she begins training them in first aid. They know something is coming. And Connolly has taken Lynn into his confidence about that. And so she's training them. But she's also training from 1914 the women of Cumann na mBan in Dublin in first aid. So she's doing all sorts of training. So she's getting to know a whole cohort of people who, for whom militancy is something they're willing to commit their lives to, for the class politics, for women, and now for the cause of Ireland. The three great causes that Markovitch, her distant relation, always spoke about: the cause of women, the cause of labour, and the cause of Ireland. And she, by 1914, is dedicated to all three. Kathleen Lynn's lifelong partner, they are now living together by 1916, Madeleine French Mullen, is with the battalion who go to Stephen's Green and eventually retreat to the Royal College of Surgeons on the Green, where they spend the week. Kathleen is in City Hall. She's third in command. The first two officers are killed, so she ends up being the senior officer in charge in City Hall when they surrender on Monday evening. Her rising only lasts about 8 hours altogether, and they spend the week then in Ship Street Barracks, and she has a very vivid description of the conditions there. That's when her diary starts. She's writing on scraps of paper. I think she realises she's in a moment, a historical moment, a moment that's going to be really important in her life and in the history of Ireland. So she starts writing her diary during that period.
And she gets moved to Mountjoy, which is a cleaner place for her than Ship Street, but she was not happy there.
No, she gets moved first to Kilmainham from Ship Street. In Ship Street, they're in terrible conditions and they're just given dog biscuits to eat for the week. And of course, the rising is going on around them and they don't know who's dead and who's alive and they're worried about their comrades. Then when everybody else surrenders, they're marched off to Kilmainham, and that's where she meets up with Madeleine again and with all the other women, 77 of whom were arrested, or 76 along with her. And they spend about 10 days in Kilmainham, and they hear the first executions. And then most of the women are released, except about a dozen of them who are considered senior dangerous Republicans and rebels, and among them is Kathleen. Moved to Mountjoy, much cleaner there, they have better conditions, but of course she's without Madeleine. And she says in her diary, Mountjoy cleaner, but I'd give £10,000 for Kilmainham and Madeleine. So again, you see the relationship is so established and so strong and will remain so for the rest of their lives until Madeleine dies.
Bring us up to the establishment of St Alton's Hospital, which is really what people who know of her probably, legacy of hers. She seemed to consistently intertwine her medical skills and knowledge with her politics.
Oh, absolutely. But she doesn't see them as separate. And she's right. They aren't separate. Healthcare is political, even to this day, as we know. There's the whole Spanish flu pandemic that happens between the rising and the setting up of St Alton's. And actually, she sets up an inoculation site in Charlemont Street in the building that will become St Alton's Hospital during the flu pandemic, and works there and works in East Wall. There is a really interesting memory of her among the older people in East Wall and the work she did among the trade union activists and the working class people and tenement dwellers around that whole area of the inner city in combating the flu. And she's really well remembered for that.
So this is 1919. And
1918, yeah.
I mean, there was a children's hospital and there was a maternity hospital. She saw the gap, which was infants.
Infants, yes. Those beyond, you know, childbirth, that's grand. You either survive or you don't and you're released. And then the children's hospital really is for older children. So this is about infants. And, you know, the age between maybe 0 and 3 or 4 is very dangerous, particularly for poorer children, in terms of not getting proper nutrition. They're living in damp dwellings. TB is rampant, all sorts of diphtheria, all sorts of childhood diseases. And they're dying in huge numbers. Infant mortality rates are extraordinarily high. So they set up St Alton's Hospital for sick infants in Charlemont Street with 2 cots and £70 in the bank and a goat.
The goat is interesting.
The goat is interesting.
What was that for?
Goat's milk. Goat's milk, because, of course, some children wouldn't be able to take cow's milk. They would be allergic to it. A lot of the women weren't able to breastfeed because they were lacking in nutrition. Their quality of life meant that their milk dried up very easily, and all sorts of other reasons why the children weren't getting breastfed. So to have a goat, and they developed then a little herd of goats in St. Alton's to have the goat's milk on tap for the children. I mean, she was always very forward looking and thinking in her medical care and what they provided in St. Alton's from the very beginning with that goat. I think for me, in a way, St. Alton's was able to be a radical space for female activism through medical practice and social practice, because not only did they run the hospital, Madeline herself were both local councillors in Rathmines and Rathgar Urban District Council. They campaigned for social housing. They campaigned for better sanitation, better healthcare, better education for the poorer children in the area. They developed the Charlemont Street flats, the French Mullen House, Charlemont Street flats, which unfortunately were demolished recently in that development there in Charlemont Street. They were designed by Michael Scott, the architect. And the description in the diaries about the opening of the Charlemont Street flats, French Mullen House, was how airy and light they were compared to the tenements. Lots of space, lots of light, lots of air. Real believer in fresh air and sunshine. She sunbathed during the winter. If there was a bit of sunshine in the sky at all, Kathleen Lynn was sunbathing. She believed, of course, vitamin D and all of that sort of thing. And the efficacy of fresh air. They had a fresh air ward in St. Alton's. And she was worked with Dr. Ella Webb on the Sunshine Homes, for example. So all of that, that female space, they all helped each other. They all worked together and they created a really radical female medical and healthcare space that was a threat, not just to other doctors, but to the state and to particularly the Catholic Church. And that came back to bite them.
And all the time, of course, there was the Catholic Church.
Yes.
What was their feeling about her and what she was doing?
Well, she was a Protestant. She was a daily communicant. Her diaries always start on with saints' days and whatnot. That's how we dated it a lot of the time. Saints' days, and she went to there were a couple of churches around that she attended, one every day. So she was a well-known Protestant, activist, radical feminist, not married, which is always suspicious in a state that privileges the domestic and marriage for women. And then when she and her St. Alton's and Harcourt Street decided they would amalgamate to create a new National Children's Hospital, this would not be under the control of the Catholic Church. All the other hospitals that dealt with women and children were. And here now you would have a space that would be secular. And secular was a bad word for the hierarchy of the church at the time. The Archbishop of Dublin was Dr. Edward Byrne at the time. And I went in when I was doing the work on the book and looked at the archives of Dr. Byrne, and particularly that communication with St. Alton's and Harcourt Street, and mainly though it is to Kathleen Lynn and the board of St. Alton's, so disparaging about the work they were doing there, but also terrified of having a hospital that deals with women and infants that is not under the control of the church, that the women would be told about contraceptives, that the children might be proselytized and turned into Protestants, that all sorts of things could go on that the Catholic Church wouldn't know about and would have no control over.
So at the point where this National Children's Hospital was being mooted, the Catholic Church presumably saw an opportunity to come in and make sure it wasn't going to happen.
They did, and they did. It didn't happen. It kind of fizzled out in the end because there was such opposition. There is a beautiful design, again done by Michael Scott, where the new children's hospital would have been stretched along the canal from Charlemont Street Bridge up to Rathmines Bridge. And it would have been there from the 1930s, and we wouldn't now have still be waiting on the new National Children's Hospital to finally be built and open.
The fact that they had bought land along the canal for this new hospital, I mean, just how disappointing was it to her that it wasn't going to happen?
Oh, very much so. But she was a very, very practical woman. You know, it eventually she accepted. She kept fighting for a long, long time. She went in to see Archbishop Byrne, went up to Archbishop's palace, had an audience with him, and he, like any the prince of the church that he was quite dismissive of her. And I find it hard to imagine, because I know Kathleen Lynn was a strong woman, a very vocal woman, very convinced of her own ideologies and the rightness of what she was doing. And this man just condescended to her and to Madeleine. Madeleine was at the meeting as well, and other members of the board. People who had achieved so much already for infants and mothers in Dublin. And just no, absolutely not, because the church would not have control.
The 1917 objectives of the League of Women, it's just remarkable to see. I mean, there was no intention of being sidelined as a woman,
no,
was there?
No, yeah. No. Oh, yeah. And they set that up to ensure that they would have representation on the senior committees in Sinn Féin. And she continues to be a senior member of Sinn Féin throughout the 20s and into the 30s. She is quite critical of Republicans in the 20s, 30s and 40s. She feels they've, you know, anti-treaty Republicans, the IRA, effectively at the time. She feels that they've lost sight of what was the First Republic, the proclamation and all of that. She also becomes quite critical, obviously, of De Valera once he leaves Sinn Féin to set up Fianna Fáil. She campaigns against the 1937 constitution. I mean, the Articles 40 and 40.1 about women in the home. Mm. Absolutely. She sees it as a Catholic document, as a fascist document. And it surprises me that people thought it was articles that were about honouring women. For women at that time, for the feminist women at that time, it was about putting women into the domestic, about making women second-class citizens. They were horrified, absolutely horrified by it. And I think she had an awareness of her place. And I think it's a place we need to honour her with now.
One of the ways you'd like that to happen is for her name to be above the National Children's Hospital, that it would be called the Kathleen Lynn National Children's Hospital. I just wonder what she would think of the shambles that have been associated with the hospital.
Oh, I would imagine she'd be horrified. When I see the amount of work that went into fundraising every penny for St. Alton's Hospital, and they stretched every penny to its ultimate degree. And they were always anxious about funds, and they used the funds absolutely to the last farthing, the last half crown, for what it was necessary for the children, for the infants and for the mothers, for the material for the hospital, for all of that. The waste and the cost would have horrified her. However, I think in a sense of restorative justice, and to perhaps put a better sheen on what is essentially a bit of a mess at the moment, it should be called the Kathleen Lynn National Children's Hospital. I can't imagine anybody else it should be called after, and calling it a sort of neutral name like they had suggested, the Phoenix Children's Hospital, is just, you know, nothing. You know, we have the James Connolly Hospital. We have many hospitals called after people. And I think Kathleen Lynn absolutely and deservedly should have that hospital called after her. She was the first one to campaign for a National Children's Hospital. She was denied that. Give her this name.
For anyone today who wants to affect change, societal change, to help people less fortunate than them, what do you think they can learn from her and her life?
Never stop. Never give in. She lost quite a lot of battles. She didn't get everything she wanted. She didn't get the Irish Republic she fought for. She didn't get the equality of women she fought for, but she continued fighting. And that's what I take from her in as a historian. I think she's an amazing figure, and the material she left and the archive and the diaries is just a boon for any historian. But as a feminist, the lesson I learned from her is you just keep on fighting. You keep on going. It never ends, you know. There is always the next fight. You might lose this one. That's just a battle. The war is still to be fought for equality, for inclusion, for better outcomes for those who are living in poverty, for children, for healthcare. All of those things as necessary today as they were when Kathleen Lynn was fighting for them.
Thanks to Michael Murphy, Siobhan Doyle and Mary McAuliffe. For more, go to rte.ie/brainstorm and you can find Brainstorm in all the usual social places. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode and subscribe to Brainstorm wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Ella McSweeney. Until next time.
Brainstorm is produced by Adrian Carty. Research was by Hazel O'Leary and recorded by Shane Dempsey at Collaborative Studios. For RTE Brainstorm, thanks to Jim Carroll, Aoife Ryan Christensen and Neil Lane. The RTE Brainstorm podcast is proudly supported by Research Ireland.